I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough.
Lin-Manuel Miranda from his Tony Award-winning musical Hamilton, the hit song My Shot. And Hamilton makes its way this week to the streaming service Disney Plus. Joining us on Film Week this week to review that and other films is Amy Nicholson, film writer for the New York Times and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom, and Christy Lemire, critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Christy and Amy, great to have you both with us. I can't wait to hear what you say about this filmed version of Hamilton live on stage at the Richard Rogers Theater with the original cast, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Philippa Soo, Leslie Odom Jr., and David Diggs. Thomas Kail is the director. Christy, what'd you think of this Disney Plus streaming version of Hamilton?
I loved it, and I have to admit, I'd never seen Hamilton.
This was it.
I know, I hadn't seen it on Broadway. I didn't see it when it came through and was the hottest ticket in town in LA. And I never really got the hype. I'm like, really? Could it be that good, really? And I knew some of the songs. And of course, Lin-Manuel Miranda is a treasure. But like, I'd never seen Hamilton. And then I watched this filmed version of the production. And I thought, oh, okay. I get it now. Now I get it. And I really wish I had seen it in a theater. You know, we're all going to watch it at home on our TVs, on Disney Plus. But I really hope that once things get back to quote unquote normal, that they'll have a theatrical run on this, because it's absolutely gorgeous. Declan Quinn is a cinematographer. And what they achieve here is really putting you in even better than the best seat in the house. You know, they have 9 cameras all over the theater. They got 100 mics. And so you can appreciate it as, you know, a stage production, but you really get a sense of intimacy and just the detail in the performances, in the songs that, you know, no ticket could buy you. And I don't think you're losing out that much on the shared communal theatrical experience. You do hear and feel that there was an audience there. But this is Hamilton, and it was shot after they won all those Tonys and before so many of the stars left the production, and they've been doing it for a while. So they were really in that sweet spot. I was just blown away by it. You know, it's just, it's absolutely gorgeous.
We're talking about Hamilton, the filmed live version from the Richard Rogers Theater that's being released this weekend on Disney Plus. Amy, what did you think?
Like Christy, I was completely ignorant of everything Hamilton, kind of on purpose. I turned down getting a ticket to Hamilton the week or the month that it opened because I thought it sounded really nerdy. and so I think out of resentment, I have resisted ever knowing a single thing about it until I watched this version of it. And it really is like you're just seeing the play in the absolute best version. And it's almost like time traveling, you know, because this is a performance from 2016, the summer of 2016. So it's pre-election. And I kept thinking, oh, man, I almost wish I could re-see it done in 2020 with more heat and more relevance to this idea of, like, who runs the country and why and who should we listen to and who gets remembered. I mean, now that I have seen Hamilton, I absolutely get why David Diggs needs to be, like, the biggest movie star on the planet. He was in Blindspotting. He was terrific in Blindspotting. And here he plays this dual role as the Marquis de Lafayette and also Thomas Jefferson. And his rap battles with Hamilton over, you know, things like taxation and states and debt are some of my favorite parts of the movie. You know, it's really great to just see the talent that they have here. You know, Renee Elise Goldsberry, she plays a woman named Angelica Schuyler. She's the older sister of Alexander Hamilton's wife. And she has, to me, I think the best number in the show. Her character is just incredible. And every time she comes out, it comes to life. You know, I will say it is over 2 hours long, and there are bits that drag a little bit. It does sometimes lose energy, but when it is good, it is very good. Also, oh my goodness, the guy who plays King George is just hilarious.
That's such a scene-stealing role. I we're talking about Hamilton, the filmed live on Broadway version, which we get to see for the first time if you're a Disney Plus subscriber. It's rated PG-13. One of the challenges, I think historically of shooting a production as it's being done on stage is, what does the director choose to highlight in a close-up? What are you then missing, perhaps, in reaction from other cast members that are around? You're making very, sometimes difficult decisions of where to focus the camera. And Christy, it sounds like you feel like Thomas Kail, the director, really made the best choices.
Well, he really found a great balance between allowing us to, take in the enormity of it. I mean, it's a pretty spare stage, but they make a lot of use of, highs and lows and various parts of it, but also when to really focus in. And so, as Amy was saying, Renee Elise Goldsberry is just a goddess, and her song Satisfied is the best song in the whole movie. I agree. But that is a number that there are a lot of moving parts. The stage is moving and it's rewinding the story. And so they really let you, capture the enormity of all of that, but then also the intimacy of what she is feeling as she tells her story through this song. And speaking of Jonathan Groff as King George, the close-up is so close. You can see the spittle flying out of his mouth as he's singing. So it really is the best of both worlds in that regard. And it's so great just to see all these actors at their peak in this show and then to have seen them go on to other film work, other stage work. It's very exciting.
Well, in this era of the pandemic, that's something you're not going to see, spittle on stage flying out anytime soon. So this is the closest you'll get. Hamilton streaming on Disney Plus, rated PG-13. The French drama The Truth stars Catherine Deneuve and Juliette Binoche, Ethan Hawke in the cast as well. It's written and directed by Hirokazu Koreeda. Amy, what do you think of The Truth?
Yeah, The Truth is a movie that a lot of people who love movies have been looking forward to, because Koreeda 2 years ago came out with his movie Shoplifters, which was just a masterpiece about a family of thieves in Japan and how their crimes build and tear apart the family that they've created on their own. And so I've been so looking forward to him making his, debut with other actors coming. This is his first film that he's been doing with parts that are in English, parts that are in French. This is now a story with Catherine Deneuve in it. And I was a little disappointed. It feels like Koreeda used his awesome clout and this attention he's getting to make kind of the standard picture I feel like we get a dozen of every year, which is it's a family, they're inside a lovely villa, this one's in France, and they're arguing about past injuries and everybody's drinking wine and there's a lot of sniping and backbiting, and then eventually there's a group hug sort of moment. And that's basically what this is, but at least you have the benefit of terrific actors. I mean, Catherine Deneuve here is playing basically an old, cold, beautiful, mean version of herself, an ancient movie actress who's just got all this clout and some resentment about how she got her career. She's written this memoir called The Truth, and the joke of the movie is that everything in that book is a lie, and her estranged daughter insists on pointing out to her that everything in this book is a lie. And so the story is really about them tangling with each other. But meanwhile, Catherine Deneuve is making this movie where that's also about mothers and daughters. It's a sci-fi kind of science fiction picture. And so it's this, subtext that's really resonant about mothers disappearing and, trauma and injury, which is lovely, but I couldn't help feeling disappointed. Koreeda had a meaner streak to him in Shoplifters, and I wanted this to be more distinct like that film was.
We're talking about the French film The Truth from writer-director Hirokazu Koreeda. Christy, what'd you think?
It's a little mean. I agree with Amy. It's not mean enough. You have actresses like Catherine Deneuve and Juliette Binoche, and they do have some Clash of the Titans moments, but it's perhaps more restrained than you're hoping for when you see that kind of casting there. Yeah, it's gentle and a little wistful. Like Hamilton, it's about who tells your story. And so Juliette Binoche as the daughter feels like, her own life is being misrepresented by her mother, doing her own rosy version of their family life. Yeah, it's another scruffy Ethan Hawke dad role, which I'm coming to enjoy this phase of his career. He's done several of these now. And there's sort of a story within the story that the film that Catherine Deneuve is working on is also about mothers and daughters and how the dynamic shifts over time and how the wielding of power evolves over time. And so the film within the film is commenting on what's going on. And there's some artistry there and some thought-provoking stuff there. But yeah, it's fine, which is not what you'd expect to say about everybody involved with this. But, you know, I enjoyed it.
We're talking about The Truth, the French drama written and directed by Horokazu Koreeda, a first movie that he's made outside of Japan, starring Catherine Deneuve, Juliette Binoche, and Ethan Hawke. The Truth rated PG, and you can see it on several video on demand platforms. John Lewis, Good Trouble, a documentary about the longtime member of Congress and civil rights activist Don Porter. The director, Amy?
Yeah, this is a documentary salute to a titanic figure in American history who definitely deserves it. You know, John Lewis, he's 80 years old today. He was there for the march from Selma to Montgomery. He was there for the bridge when they got attacked by cops and he got hit in the head. And this is a story about voting rights that takes place in two parallel times. You know, one, his timeline back in the 60s when he was marching with Martin Luther King, and the one that we're having today. You know, you have people like Stacey Abrams, Ayanna Pressley, AOC, Ilhan Omar show up to talk about how we might have made some steps forward in the fight to make sure that everybody who wants to vote can vote in this democracy. But we still have a lot of problems, you know, happening since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013. So it's, you know, kind of a firebranding documentary that half seems to take place more around John Lewis than it does with him, learning so much about him and his individual story. But some of the footage they have of the march from Selma to Montgomery, you know, there's angles of it I've never seen, an immediacy to it that I've never seen. That's really powerful to rewatch. It felt like a great movie to watch now to see basically how a struggle gets conducted and how struggles need to keep getting conducted. I mean, it's called Good Trouble because John Lewis himself has been arrested, oh gosh, 4 dozen times. It, you know, he intends on probably getting arrested a few more times, and that's what it takes. So it does feel like a good documentary for the moment, even though it's a little bit slight in the edges.
Christy, what'd you think of John Lewis, Good Trouble?
Good Trouble is sort of his mantra. He encourages folks to this day, get into good trouble, necessary trouble, trouble to make the change that needs to occur. And Elijah Cummings has a good line in this film about how he's such an effective leader because he's lived it. He's been through all of this. And so his longevity and his vitality are on display here. He is this seemingly ageless octogenarian and is totally beloved wherever he goes, and understandably so, and is as charismatic and as able to connect one-on-one with a woman after church in the parking lot as he is with, you know, a giant crowd at a campaign rally. And this is very much a love letter to John Lewis, who, you know, very much deserves that. The director, Don Porter, doesn't really press him on anything. She doesn't really ask any uncomfortable questions. She does conduct some interviews with him in a way that is reminiscent of Errol Morris's interviewing style, in that it allows them the opportunity to look straight into the camera and talk. And just the warmth and the wisdom that he has to impart are quite impactful. Great archival footage. And then the film follows him throughout his day. And it's amazing the schedule he still maintains. So it's a great appreciation of John Lewis without necessarily prompting him to anything uncomfortable.
John Lewis, Good Trouble, rated PG. The documentary can be seen on 3 different art house cinema sites: Lemley's Virtual Cinema, the Frida Virtual Cinema, and Alamo On Demand. Just want to mention that our critics also have some favorite films of summer. Amy, quickly, number one on your list, An American Tale of 1986. Give us 30 seconds on that, please.
Well, I was thinking about it in part because, you know, we're heading into the 4th of July weekend, and I think this is one of our best all-American stories. I mean, it's basically The Godfather 2 for kids. You have the Russian Jewish Pavel Moskowitz escaping the persecution in Russia of these cat pogroms. And when he gets to New York, it's a story about everything: immigration, labor conditions, backdoor politics. It's got charm and heart, and Madeline Kahn as a rich dowager mouse. I mean, who doesn't want that?
An American Tale from 1986, available on multiple services. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. Back with our critics in a minute. You're listening to Film Week. Perhaps you got it from your favorite place to get podcasts, or you're listening on 89.3 KPCC or kpcc.org or the KPCC app. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. We're joined by critics Christy Lemire and Amy Nicholson. The next film they'll tell us about is The Outpost. The drama stars Orlando Bloom, Caleb Landry-Jones, and Scott Eastwood. Rod Lurie is the director, and the screenwriters are Eric Johnson and Paul Tamasi. Christy, what'd you think of The Outpost?
I liked it a lot. It's a really solidly made, really well-acted film. It's quite beautifully shot. This is like Hamilton. I wish I had the opportunity to see this on a big screen. Rod Lurie makes these very solid, no-nonsense, substantial action films, political films. He went to West Point, so telling stories of the military are very important to him. This is based on a book by Jake Tapper at CNN about this team of U.S. soldiers who were based in Afghanistan at the base of Three Mountains, and they were just absolutely sitting ducks and massively outnumbered in 2009 when a group of Taliban came over the hill and just attacked them. And these weren't like the elite squadron of soldiers here. These are regular guys who just through sheer will, you know, fought them back, and many lives were lost, and a couple of guys won the Medal of Honor. And it's it is not a glorifying story at all, but there is great respect and great reverence. And it's also shot in long takes, so it puts you in the middle of the action. And it reminded me quite a bit of Full Metal Jacket, in that the first half of it is letting you know who these guys are, setting up their dynamic, their relationships. And then the second half of it is all this big, long battle, and it's quite intense. And Caleb Landry-Jones is great in it, as is Orlando Bloom. It's an impressive cast of young actors, and it's really good.
The Outpost, the movie. Amy, you concur?
I didn't love it quite as much as Christy. I think I have a lower tolerance for like macho, blah, 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 blah kind of movies, which this definitely is. But it does have really some incredible, really cool camera movements that I appreciate in here a lot. And I was nervous that this is going to be that kind of Rara, based on a true story movie that winds up being, I find, like really virulently xenophobic. We've had a few of those from the War on Terror. This one isn't quite so bad. The anger here is mostly placed on the U.S. commanders and their bad orders and their lack of any real mission. So the target here I find really interesting, but I do have to second, like, my main reason for hitting play on this movie was Caleb Landry-Jones, who people might know as kind of the skinny, crazy, racist brother in Get Out. He's one of the most exciting young actors, and I wasn't sure how he could play a soldier. You know, he doesn't seem to play soldier types, but he played it off really well. And every time he shows up on screen, to me, this movie kicked up from okay to awesome.
The Outpost, starring Orlando Bloom and Caleb Landry-Jones, Rod Lurie the director. It's rated R, based on Jake Tapper's book, The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor, and it's available on multiple on-demand platforms. Fire on the Hill, a documentary about the Compton Cowboys that features footage of the writers who were part of the Compton Cowboys, interviews with them. Brett Fallentine is the director of the documentary. Amy.
Yeah, this is a great documentary, a really local story that I hope people check out, because it's not just a story about, you know, the Compton Cowboys who deserve to be recognized. It's really well done. The editing is gorgeous. The cinematography is gorgeous. It is a really high-class documentary. You know, the Compton Cowboys, for people who don't know, they started here in Compton from like real guys who were cowboys who came out, lived here, brought their horses, created stables, and then through the subsequent generations, people have realized, you know, like, gosh, when I'm on the stables and I'm riding a horse, I'm able to get away from the nonsense of my block, and I'm able to feel free, a type of freedom that I think the people who are a part of the Compton Cowboys really say is like the reason why they like to ride. And what you have here is kind of three stories happening at once. You have one of the leaders of the Compton Cowboys of a sort who's trying to build them a new stable when their first stable burns down. That's what Fire on the Hill, the title, refers to. Then you have the story of like a guy from Compton who's actually competing in rodeos. He's really terrific, but he's having a hard time getting sponsorships. He's having a hard time becoming a rodeo guy. And it's, there's a little bit in there about what is it like to be one of the only, you know, black riders on the rodeo cowboy circuit. And then there's just a guy named Calvin who does DMV security. And, you know, riding a horse is a way to try to keep his life in line when he's making a lot of kind of screwed up decisions and he's not sure where he wants to go with his life. So there's these three really human stories pulling this along, and I was just knocked out. I mean, I could watch footage over footage of just like watching a guy on a horse pulling back, and then suddenly you're over the freeway and you're just the culture clash of just seeing, you know, the concrete of Los Angeles and these riders looking so magnificent on their horses is unbelievable.
We're talking about the documentary Fire on the Hill. Christy.
It's incredibly beautiful. And this is the first feature from the director, which is amazing because there's real ambition in the way that he shoots it. As Amy was mentioning, it just is such a trip seeing, you know, anybody on horseback walking through the streets of Los Angeles, but the juxtaposition of like the squalor in the freeway underpasses and the high tension power lines behind them as the sun is setting in the distance, there's like a really cool combination of kind of old fashioned Western iconography with just bracing, you know, contemporary imagery. And the stories are all well told. They feel very thorough. I feel like I got to know all three of these guys and their stories. They touch a little bit on the element of racism that they may have encountered at these rodeos on this circuit. I kind of wish they had explored what that is like a little bit more, because really these three guys are like the only ones in a giant crowd of white people for whom, you know, white Americana is, you know, it's a brand. And I wish they'd explore that a little bit more. But yeah, this is a slice of life. This is what great documentaries should do, right? They should open your eyes to a slice of life that you've never even known before. And that's what this does so well.
And it's the Compton Cowboys, profiled in Fire on the Hill, documentary from Brett Fallentine. It's unrated. It debuted a couple years ago at the LA Film Festival, and now it's available for you to see at home on Amazon Prime Video. Also out this week, a documentary on Spanish language television icon, astrologer Walter Mercado, who died not too long ago. In fact, on Air Talk, we did a full segment devoted to him because of his iconic presence on Spanish language TV. The documentary, which streams on Netflix starting next week, is titled Mucho, Mucho Amor. Amy, what'd you think of the documentary on Mercado?
Oh, I mean, this is just a glitter bomb. This is just the funnest little documentary. You know, it starts off kind of like a mystery. You know, Walter Mercado was huge. You know, Howard Stern is even here saying that he is bigger than Jesus Christ. And when the documentary starts, he is still alive, but he's been disappeared for a decade. So there's a touch of mystery to it. And what you wind up doing is going inside of his estate in Puerto Rico, where he's living a little bit of a Sunset Boulevard existence with his assistant, Willie. And, you know, from there you go and, like, you trace over his whole life. Like, he was a misfit in a small town, and then he learned to embrace being a misfit and just wear these sequined capes and show up everywhere and be just this magical, almost religious presence. And I have to admit, I was a little bit skeptical going into this because I remember Walter Mercado, you know, from growing up in Texas in the 90s and always seeing his psychic hotline, you know, pitches on air and thinking that guy is a gigantic fraud. And what the documentary says is, well, his heart is in the right place. His heart is very true. I wish that it had given a little bit more time to say, like, people who spent a lot of money on the psychic hotline that they didn't necessarily have to spend. The movie ignores all of that. You know, it ignores anything negative that could be associated with him and blames most stuff on his ex-manager. But if you just want to, like, be blessed by Walter Mercado's presence, this movie was delightful.
We're talking about the documentary Mucho, Mucho Amor. Christy.
Yes, this is the other movie this week starring Lin-Manuel Miranda, because one of the more memorable moments in this movie is when Lin and his father Luis go to meet Walter Mercado, and they're each starstruck by each other, and Lin-Manuel Miranda is like brought to tears at the very sight of him, which just let you know what a cultural icon he was for so long, for in so many regions of the world. I agree with Amy. I wish that the directors had pressed him a little more. You know, there are definitely some elements of his persona and his fame and his, you know, his vocation that could use a little more examination, right? I mean, he meant well, but does he have any kind of remorse over, you know, decisions people might have made based on his advice? Like, did he have any kind of qualification whatsoever to do this? Or was he just a really exciting, flamboyant personality who was beloved? They don't want us to think about these things. They want us to focus on how delightful he was and how sad it was that things turned out for him the way they did with his manager taking advantage of him. And they want us to revel in the glitter and the glamour of all of his capes. And there's a big museum exhibit in Miami that it all ends up at, where he's just absolutely worshipped and adored. And it's entertaining, but a little slight.
Well, do they get into the issue? I mean, much like Liberace, he had tremendous appeal to middle-aged women. And, you know, this in a culture where machismo is part of it. And here's this guy, very Liberace-like in his presentation and sort of how his sexuality just is, in a sense, ignored, and he becomes a beloved figure. Was any of that part of this documentary?
Only very slightly. That's one of the things I wish they had talked about a little bit more. Yeah.
They do touch on it a little bit, and like how he was such a figure he was such a target for homophobic comedians, you know, which the jokes he put up with, you watch his face put up with a lot of jokes. And I think those scenes are really powerful.
Mucho, Mucho Amor, a documentary about one of the iconic figures in Spanish language TV for many years, Walter Mercado, who died November of last year, yet less than a year ago. The Netflix streaming documentary is Unrated. It's directed by Christina Constantini and Kareem Tapsch. Homewrecker, a horror comedy directed by Zach Gain. Precious Chong, Alex Esso, and Zach Gain are the screenwriters. It stars Chong and Esso. Amy, what'd you think of Homewrecker?
Yeah, this is a tiny thriller that looks like it was made for about $10. That these three people, Precious Chong, Alex Esso, and Zach Gain, got into a room and are like, let's make a movie. And they did. And the movie is okay. You know, the story here is Alex Esso, who is a young actress I really like. You know, she was in Starry Eyes. She's the splashback Shelley Duvall in the Shining sequel that came out recently. She is just this really super, super passive, nice girl who's married, and she winds up agreeing to go to the house of a girl that she knows from her gym class. And this girl is like older. She's from the 80s, as like a popular mean girl from the 80s, who is now just kind of lonely and a little bit crazy in her house and just wants to spend girl time with Alex. And very quickly, within like an hour of basically them knowing each other, it turns into more of a misery-like situation. I wish this movie was a little bit more fun and twisty than it was. It's definitely very, very thin. But sometimes they have these conversations with each other where they're playing board games and talking about, you know, self-esteem and femininity. And I appreciate that. It kind of feels like the 80s mean girl Precious Chong, who's very fun, is playing this movie more like a satire. And Alex, the girl who gets kidnapped, is more of a straight heroine, very empathetic, and you care about her a lot. So it doesn't quite gel for me, but for a movie that was made for $10, it's definitely worth a watch.
Homewrecker is the horror comedy from director Zach Gain. It's unrated and available on Google Play, Vudu, and Fantango Now. That's a chance for us to talk about some more of the recommendations for summer or Independence Day watching by our critics. And Christy, you've actually put together a number of films that feature firework scenes, great scenes, including Brokeback Mountain. I don't even remember the fireworks scene from that.
Oh, it's the first one I thought of. Oh, yeah. There's the 4th of July picnic that they go to, and Heath Ledger's character gets into this fight with just these loudmouth jerks who are sitting behind them. And when he stands up, it's this low angle on the camera, and he's in his hat with his denim jacket and his jeans on, and the fireworks are all erupting behind him, and it's so dramatic. And it's this fascinating contradiction between the purity and the joy of the moment and the simmering rage that's in him. And then they cut to Michelle Williams looking at him holding their kid. And like, you realize that she realizes for the first time that she does not really know the man that she thinks she knows and loves. And it's a really dramatic, powerful moment. But when I think of Fireworks, that's the first one I thought of.
I'm so glad you put together this list of movies with great fireworks scenes, because without any professional fireworks shows in Southern California, amateur shows are another thing, we can turn to movies and to see them there. Brokeback Mountain, of course, from 2005, Heath Ledger, Michelle Williams. It's available to stream on Hulu or HBO Max and available to rent on multiple different platforms. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Christy's going to have more of those movies with great fireworks scenes. And we have from Amy more holiday summer picks as well. And we probably have time to hit a couple more theatrical streaming releases that are new. No theatrical films for a while, given the order that we've just gotten from Governor Newsom. Movie theaters will be closed at least 3 weeks more. We'll be back with more in a minute. So good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. KPCC's John Horn has a brand new podcast from LA Studios. It is Hollywood the Sequel, and John has a number of big-name guests who'll be talking about a couple of primary themes. We're going to hear from him very shortly with one of those interviews with the actor, producer, director, Kerry Washington. But the couple of themes are Hollywood getting back to production after the pandemic shutdown. The other is about Hollywood's efforts to become more inclusive, more reflective of today's America. And we'll hear that interview, Kerry Washington, coming up a little bit later right here on Film Week. But we continue with our Film Week critics, Amy Nicholson and Christy Lemire, with the comedy Desperados, which is streaming on Netflix. The film is directed by LP, and it stars Nassim Pedrad. Amy?
Yeah, Nassim Pedrad. She is a Saturday Night Live star, and this is one of her, like, here is your focal point, gross-out girls comedy, which I was not a giant fan of. This movie's very strident. But the story here is that Nassim is this very desperate single. She's trying to get dates. She's trying to get jobs, and her big downfall is she talks way too much and she's completely unhinged and crazy. So she decides to not do that and become a completely different person and become like a quiet, timid person to seduce this like really bland hottie who likes dull girls who are no drama. And so it works for a tiny bit, and then she winds up thinking he ghosted her, and she sends him this furious, angry, horrible email and discovers that he was actually in a coma and he wasn't ghosting her. So she enlists her friends to go with her to Mexico, where her man was in a coma, to basically break into his computer and delete the email before he can recognize it so he can continue to love her for being the person that she's not. And from there, you're like, that could be a fun premise, but it's actually like a movie where she gets hit in the face with a dolphin penis. So it's a little bit unhinged. The person who comes off the best here in a movie that does not shy away from things like pedophilia jokes is Lamorne Morris. He plays the guy that she should be with, and he is an absolutely charming person. Every time Lamorne Morris showed up, I was like, oh, I want to see a romantic comedy with this guy. He's incredible. But the rest of this movie made me embarrassed to be a woman. Every single woman in this movie is very crazy in some sort of cliche way. Like, oh no, I need to have a baby today, and oh no, blah, 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 blah. It's very shrill.
It's a Netflix comedy starring Nassim Pedrad, directed by LP. That's the working name of Lauren Palmigiano. Ellen Rappaport is the screenwriter, and it's unrated. The documentary The Medicine looks at the controversy surrounding the remedy ayahuasca, which is increasingly popular in the West. Christy, how was the documentary?
Well, it's essentially an extended infomercial for the healing powers of ayahuasca. And then specifically, it feels like an ad for this high-end luxury resort in Costa Rica where you can go and do ayahuasca and also have like organic farm-to-table meals and mud baths and yoga and life coaching. But it follows two people. One is actress Annalyn McCord, who was on the reboot of 90210. She was on Nip Tuck. And then former NFL safety Kerry Rhodes, and how they have both found their way to this Costa Rican resort in search of something, in search of the answers that they hope that, you know, imbibing ayahuasca will provide for them. And the film essentially suggests that, like, all the ills of the world could be healed if we could just tap into the brain power that ayahuasca unleashes for us. If we could just find the spirituality that we experience when we do this. And they interview the guy who runs the resort and his wife. It's kind of sketchy. If you're going to do this kind of thing, you're going to do it. If you're not, I don't think this film is going to talk you into it.
It's sure widely available on a ton of on-demand platforms starting Tuesday of next week. Farzin Tusi is the director. The Medicine is unrated. And finally, the Chilean drama The Prince, starring Alfredo Castro, Sebastian Munoz is the director. Amy?
Yeah, if you would like a movie with really beautifully lit nudity, this is definitely your movie for the week. The Prince is about a man who gets sent to prison when he's very young. And this prison is basically like 50 Shades of Grey. Everybody has a boyfriend. It's very romantic and love triangle intense. There's a lot of jealousy and anger and knowing looks and spooning and a lot of nudity, just lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of nudity. It's kind of like a classy, cute romantic film in a way. You know, there's a scene I really like where they're playing tango love songs to each other and they're singing and dancing, scattered with bits of, you know, being attacked by broomsticks and people getting killed. This movie's kind of all over the place, honestly, the more I talk about it out loud, because I also want to say that there's a very cute cat named Plato who's also in this film. So if you want a floofy cat and a very erotically charged prison, I suppose this is the movie for you this week.
The Prince, available on Blu-ray and DVD. The Chilean drama is unrated. Well, let's turn our attention to summer films that our critics have chosen. And Amy, let me go to you to talk a bit about the Tribeca Drive-In series that starts at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena 4 days a week through the end of July. And it's quite a lineup of films.
Yeah, this is very exciting. I mean, I'm a huge drive-in nut, and since drive-ins are the safest way that we can see movies right now, I love that Tribeca is throwing this, you know, drive-in that's going to be happening at the Rose Bowl pretty much two times a day, 4 days a week. It's great. They're programming all the heavy hitters. I mean, it's like Apollo 13 and Wizard of Oz and John Wick and Mean Girls. It's everything you want to see that you've probably seen a million times. But if you want to see it in as summery of an atmosphere as I think we're going to get, it's nice. They're selling tickets by the carloads. You can pack up your car with everybody that you know who's safe and head out to the drive-in. They also say that they're showing these films, you know, while the sun is up, which I'm not entirely sure how that's going to work, but I would like to trust they figured it out.
Well, I assume so. You know, the Hollywood Bowl, when it does events, you know, concerts that start during the day, their display screens, like baseball stadiums, are bright enough that they can do that. So I'm guessing they must be using something similar to show these films. And one thing to clarify, because they're billing this as at the Rose Bowl. It's not in the Rose Bowl. It's in the parking lot right now. But you'll have a beautiful view of the Rose Bowl, too, as you watch the films. That's the Tribeca Drive-In series that starts this weekend. And back to you, Christy, to share with us again Fireworks Films' Beasts of the Southern Wild, which is just a visually spectacular film from 2012.
It's so beautiful, and just the magical realism of it is so gripping. But again, as with my previous pick, Brokeback Mountain, the use of the fireworks is kind of like a contrast with the underlying tension that's going on here. It takes place way, way far south in the bayou. And it's this little girl, Hush Puppy, who thinks that where she lives is so magical. It's played by Kevenjane Wallace, who got an Oscar nomination for this. And the scene I'm referring to is there's this huge celebration and everyone's got fireworks going off. And one of the signature images of the film is Kevenjane Wallace running with a sparkler in each hand. And it's so remote down there that the sky is just pitch black. And it's so far away from every other kind of humanity, it seems, in their own little world down there. But a storm is coming that is going to upend their idol down there. But for a while, for this one magical moment, it's paradise.
Beasts of the Southern Wild, available on multiple platforms. And a few others, just we've got only about a minute left, so I'm going to mention them. To Catch a Thief from 1955, Grace Kelly and Cary Grant with fireworks going off behind them. Born on the 4th of July from 1989, starring Tom Cruise. Independence Day from 1996, and Jaws. The beaches open on July 4th in Jaws, not of course here in Southern California, but that's of course central to the plot there of Jaws from 75. Also want to mention from Amy, A League of Their Own, just a terrific film from Penny Marshall. Gina Davis stars. Terrific look at the Women's Professional Baseball League that was active during World War II. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, John Horne's new podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. We have a wonderful interview excerpt from that coming right up on Film Week here on KPCC.